Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone. This is the live event. In the dead of night, when thy winter wounds shall not be healed from the wind which howls about your being. In the dead of night, when your friends have gone and you sit huddled by the castle's fire. In the dead of night, when all is dark, who will you be tonight? The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, KV at MTOR, ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knott. Laura Kettledge is a paranormal author who writes for our good friends over at the UFODigest.com, author of a number of books which we shall discuss tonight. Laura Kettledge, tonight, in the shadows of the Night Zone, looking to email the show, The Night Zone, one word, thenightzone@gmail.com.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madam and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition of The Night Zone. It is Tuesday, August the 31st, 2010. Laura Kettledge is with us tonight, and we shall be discussing her work and a couple of very strange paranormal happenings on her farm. Huge shout out to Dave the Wire Puller. Great to bump into you the other day. We'll catch up on old times soon. Isn't Facebook wonderful? Huge hello to Snow42. Definitely looking forward to our chat. And to the RCMP officer on Highway 3 in British Columbia, who gave me the finger wag instead of a ticket. I gave it the website, of course. Thank you. As we go to air tonight, Europe is ablaze. Wildfires spreading throughout Europe, fueled by ferocious wind. Record temperatures in eastern Canada. Earthquakes rumbling throughout the world. Volcanoes erupting after 400 years of dormancy. Floods throughout the ages, Pakistan, China, polar caps melting and breaking away from the continental shelf, and the sun spewing plasma and radiation at the Earth. Is all this associated with 2012? Is there a Planet X inbound? Do the Anunnaki truly exist? And did the ancients know our fate? Could our fate have also have been their fate? Many questions have been answered in the shadows of the Night Zone, and many more questions yet to be asked. We will continue to bring you the best of the best in the paranormal field, the best in the author field, and with your continued help and advice, along with guest suggestions, we will bring it all to you each week. We do need your help on one thing. As you listen to the archived editions, please take time to rate the show. This gives us more opportunity to target specific guests to fill listener requirements. So remember to rate the shows and mark them as a favorite. Tonight, Laura Kettledge is with us, and we're going to look at some of Laura's work. Some very interesting stuff coming up in the Night Zone. Hang in there.
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com. 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. Your host, Colin Knight.
And Laura Kettledge, author of one of my favorite books, Throwaway Horses. And we'll get to that book in a little while. Laura, it's a pleasure to have you in the Night Zone tonight.
Well, thank you. And I have to tell you that I never miss your show.
Well, I appreciate that very, very much. It's good to know that good people like you are out there, that's for sure. We'll get to your books in just a little while, but I just want to kind of set the stage here. You've been writing since you were a little girl, living all over the country and basically drawing upon those experiences to mold your characters for the books and aspect.
Not quite. No, okay. I never thought of myself as an author whatsoever. It just never occurred to me. Though you're right, I have lived in various places, New York City, Daytona Beach, Florida, Lexington, Kentucky, Northern Virginia, and things like that. But I started writing after I had a psychic dream in 1987.
Holy Toledo. And what did this dream bring to you at the time? Did it make sense when you had the dream? Was it?
Well, it was actually very, very surreal. Yes, it did make sense. I dreamt my first novel.
Wow. And you dreamt the outcome of it or actually writing the words?
No, I dreamt the scenes, what the horse looked like and that my character's horse looked like, just lots of details. And the idea, I feel, was like planted in my brain. And I was living in New York City at the time, and I was absolutely flat broke because I left my husband and I, you know, things couldn't have been worse. And then I had this dream, and it was an epiphany. And I thought to myself, well, I'm not an author. I can't write this story. And I kind of doodled around for 10 years, and then I actually sat down and write it, and this whole thing just kind of, you know, it took on a life of its own, and has become three novels now.
Wow. Now, when you first started getting this this urge to write, when it started coming out, did you feel that you were being guided at that time, or was this using what you had learned in life already, or was there more to it than that?
There's kind of more to it. It's kind of weird. I'm totally dyslexic, and I flunked out of junior college. That shows what an avid student I am, though I am self-educated and fairly well-traveled. In 1979, I had a terrible accident, and I died. And before I was resuscitated, I had a near-death experience. And, you know, people didn't talk about it back then. And I went to the doctor and tried to tell the doctor and, you know, tried to make sense of it because I certainly wasn't the paranormal type whatsoever. And, you know, I think there was a huge connection between that and the book because the novel is called The Near-Death Connection that I wrote, or this story that I came up with, and each of my characters in this small group has had a near-death experience, and that's what I write about. So one thing linked to another. Isn't that funny?
It is. It's the linkage of life in itself, to be honest with you. You know, they talk about the degrees of separation, but it is truly amazing how people are linked together either in time, space, or by energy of some kind. I do agree. Now, this accident in 79, mm-hmm. This was a riding accident on a horse, correct?
Yes, I had rented a horse for the afternoon, and there were some gentlemen riding behind me, but they were way behind me. And if it wasn't for them, I don't think I would be alive or I would have been able to come back. And the horse took off with me, and I went face first, I guess, into a ditch, a ravine or whatever, and it killed me. Luckily, I wasn't dead too long. You know, I didn't come back a vegetable or anything, but it was a pretty surreal experience.
So when did you realize that you had died? When was that moment of realization?
Pretty much immediately. I knew as I was falling. I thought to myself, this is it. And there's not too many points in your life where you know, feel that dramatic, you know, like you're hanging over a cliff and about to fall. I knew this was it, and as I was falling, I never hit the ground. I left my body, and I plunged into this deep, dark pit or a tunnel. I guess that's a classic experience, you know, for other people, but, you know, I was 19 years old, and, you know, I was just, you know, a kid who just thought about her social life and all the stupid things a teenager does, and I had never heard about this sort of thing, so I was very shocked. I was very shocked when it happened.
Now, when this happened to you, did you feel your own sense of space when it was happening, or did you just feel that you were just part of everything? Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I was still me.
Yeah.
I was still me. I didn't have a body, but I was still me.
Right. And you, your system reacted as if you were still in existence.
My who?
Your body, the way you reacted would still be in character, if you will. Right?
Oh yeah, definitely had my own personality flaws and all. It went with me.
Right.
Yeah, I was definitely still me, and going through this experience, especially being a kid without that kind of maturity, it made it 10 times more dramatic.
True. Yeah. Now, how long did you stay out of your body or at the near death, the point of near death? How long would you say that whole interaction took?
Well, I could not have been dead for a minute. I mean, because, you know, brain cells die and people, you know, they didn't have, you know, equipment there in the field. So, but when I was dead, it felt like a very, very long journey, very detailed experiences and conversations. And linear time, it's not, time there is not what time is here. Now, that's a hard thing to, you know, conceive in your mind, but it's true. So it felt like a very long experience for me. Not days and weeks, but a long time.
And people have stated the same thing, that they've had maybe a 10-minute lost time experience,
mm-hmm.
yet they've experienced days of experimentation or days of enlightenment, and yet they've only been
I can definitely I can definitely understand that one.
Yeah, yeah. As you realized that you were dead, did you think of how could you revive yourself? Was that a
Oh, I was in no rush to come back. I didn't want to come back at all. I was pretty very, very upset. And I was in a personal turmoil because it was such a shock. You know, when you're sick, you know, it crosses your mind that you could die, really, when you're very, very sick. It's something that, you know, there's a preface for. But when you have such a sudden accident and you're a kid, you just never saw, I never saw it coming.
Right.
So it made it worse.
Right. Made it 10 times worse. You had no preparation.
There was none. No. No, there was none.
Mm-hmm. So after this incident, and it took you another 10 years, you began to write the Near-Death Connection.
Well, this is also, you know, I started having psychic experience after my near-death experience at 19. Then I started to have, like, a psychic awakening where I was seeing ghosts from time to time and grappling with that and having, you know, this sixth sense that I never had before the accident. And I was so shook up about it, I went to a psychiatrist. I thought I might be having a schizophrenic break, and she was very, very avant-garde, should we say, and she said, well, you know, I really think, Laura, that you've had a near-death experience, and other people have had this, and no, you're not crazy, and, you know, it's something that is going to be a part of your life, so try to adjust to it. And I didn't talk about it for 30 years with anybody except, you know, one or two family members. I really kept the lid on this and kept it a very secret part of my personal life for years. And I came out of the closet a year ago.
And you did that because of shame or because you thought nobody would believe you?
Oh, no, I really didn't care if they believed me or not. You know, I'm not out to recruit anybody. I just thought, well, you know, it's not exactly something you bring up at dinner or on a first date. I just didn't think it was anybody's business, and it was something that was growing, that was happening to me, and, you know, I was glad about it. I'm still very glad about it, but I just didn't feel, quote, the need to share until
right.
a year ago.
Right. And now that you have managed to get your feelings, your inner thoughts onto paper and into book form, how does it make you feel? Does it feel you have fulfilled something that has been ordered of you or required of you?
It feels wonderful. Like when I finished the first novel a few years ago, I was just like, oh my gosh, I had all of these psychic experiences that I put into different fictional characters, and I do a lot of explaining about the other dimensions and the thing, my beliefs, but I put them into a fictional format and a pretend world, and I don't preach at people. You know, I can't stand that, you know, about some authors. They preach at you, and it's nothing like that at all. This is a lot of entertainment, but there are some very true psychic experiences in all of my novels. There really are.
And these are drawn from your experiences throughout your childhood and growing into adulthood.
Inspired. Well, I didn't have psychic experience until I was 19.
Right, so. Until after the accident.
Yeah.
So do you think the accident triggered some kind of psychic phenomenon in you?
Oh, absolutely. Something happened when I was dead, or I brought something back with me from death, and I've got it still, and it's a sixth sense or whatever you say. It's not like I have a lot of control over it. It happens when it happens, and when I want it to happen, it never does. But this morning, I was awoke, you know, something woke me up, and I looked to my left, and there was a spirit in the room, and I just felt, instead of being, you know, like scared or anything like that, I feel comforted. I mean, I just feel like, you know, I have souls that watch over me, that nurture me from time to time. Sometimes it's frustrating. They don't help me enough, you know, communication enough, but other times I get good communication. So it's pretty interesting.
So... When you began writing your first novel,
mm-hmm.
Were these, as you began writing, were you thinking of writing from a first-person kind of perspective? Did the writing cover itself?
No, I mean, this story, I mean, I do a lot of narrative, and there's quite a bit of dialogue, but no, this is not first-person. Now, the articles I write, like for UFO Digest and on my magazine columns, because I've got several columns on the Internet that I regularly write for, are all first-person true stories of mine. But when I write my novels, these are fictional characters and fictional story.
But they must have some basis.
Oh, boy, they sure do. They definitely do. I'll draw on my own psychic experiences and embellish. And, I'm not that creative. I mean, I'd like to think I'm creative, but I couldn't make this up. I mean, there's a lot of truths in it.
Interesting. I tell you what, Laura, we'll take a quick break here, pause for the cause. When we come back, we'll talk about your second book, which happens to be my favorite. So we'll talk about that one when we come back.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Nikola Tesla single-handedly changed the world for the benefit of mankind, yet has been rewarded with obscurity. It's time to bring his story out of the shadows and into the light. With his last breath, Nikola gently smiled.
Let the future tell the truth and evaluate each one according to his work and accomplishments. The present is theirs. The future, for which I have really worked, is mine.
Would they only have listened?
Nikola Tesla, an upcoming show in the Night Zone. Watch for the listings on blogtalkradio.com. Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone.
The ancient Sumerian text, just in a very broad overview, basically tell us that these Anunnaki came from space and landed on the Earth in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They began to set up a colony that they called Eden.
phone lines are now open. 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. Program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered. We remind all of our listeners, KVDM Tour. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
And we are back with Laura Cutledge. And Laura, in your second book, let me make sure I can get you back online. There we go. In your In your second book, Throwaway Horses. I got to tell you, that one captured my attention. I thought that was such an interesting twist of a story.
Well, it's definitely very different. You know, it's the sequel to The Near-Death Connection, and I have this very interesting, colorful character, Sharon Landry, who is loosely based on myself, and she kind of reveals a secret to her friends, and she'll go back to her first person, recount when she did this very bad thing, and it takes you back to 1959. It becomes a period piece because the book is set in 1981. So it takes you back to 1959 in Ormond Beach, Florida. And I write about my hometown, and Sharon lives there. And then it's a long, involved story, but it ends up at a horse slaughterhouse in Ouchaloocola, just south of Jacksonville. Now, Ouchaloo is an Indian name from Seminoles, and Ouchaloocola is actually fictional because if I put it in a real town, someone might have a mob chasing me, you know? But I'm very passionate about horse rescue, and, you know, it's not the whole center of the story's throwaway horses, but it's actually based on true facts, how, you know, it's not the old nag that goes to the slaughterhouse. Many horses today in the United States really are being stolen right out of people's backyards, healthy, beautiful animals, and they go to the slaughterhouse, and they're butchered. And, you know, I'm not a big tree hugger, you know, PETA person, but after I wrote this book and I did all my research, boy, it makes you think twice.
They use fake papers to sell them, or what?
Well, what happens is, and it's going on today, but in my story, you know, there's a slaughterhouse, and these two brothers run it, and they're getting all the horses that they can, you know, by hook or by crook, and they're slaughtering them and sending the meat overseas, where in Japan today, it's like $25 a pound for horse meat.
Right. And France is very big on horse meat, too.
Yeah, French love it, and so do the people, the Belgian people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a delicacy in France, for sure. And it's strange how different cultures have different beliefs, but, you know, you would pay the same amount of price for monkey brains in some countries. So
I'm going to be a vegetarian at the end of the show.
I mean, it's a horrible thought, but, but I really did like, first of all, the title of the book, you know, the way it came together, Throwaway Horses, it just says it the way it is. It sets it up with no real ambiguity. It just tells you the way it is. And
well, I'm going to be pitching this book to Hollywood probably this winter and trying to see if it could be made into a movie.
Well, there you go. That'd be wonderful, you know.
I think that this one really, really could be made into a good Hollywood movie, and it's a little bit more than you think about the horse thing. I didn't preach about this. It's just like a background thing, but you'd be surprised. You know, the slaughterhouse is built over where there's an Indian massacre, because the Seminoles ruled Florida at one time, and this is before the white man, and I put an Indian massacre and just a lot of little different folklore and history and about Florida in it.
Right. Now, in that book, you made a reference to Julie Goodman and the paranormal event about spirits which came from nowhere and surrounded her. Now, was that taken from real life, or was that just darn good writing?
Oh, you're so sweet. Darn good writing here. The thing is about my character, Sharon Landry, you know, she does have this crisis, this thing, this event that happened, but I go past it. I go past, you know, the slaughterhouse, and she is a psychic, and, you know, she goes to work at a hospital, you know, after there's been a death in her family, and, you know, she sees ghosts, and she has such a turn of, there's a whole mystery here and a whodunit, and I'm trying to tell you little things without giving away the plot line, and it's really hard to do.
Well, yeah. And to do that, they got to go get the books, and we'll get to that toward the end of the show. But I like the touch. It was a nice, and I read it, and I looked at it, and I read it again, and you put the words together, and if that is merely writing, then bravo, definitely.
Oh, you're so good to me. Thank you.
No, it's just the truth. So do you feel inspired when you are writing? Do these stories come together without too much correction, or do you have to go through a lot of rewrites before you get to the last page?
Oh, hon, I rewrite a lot. It took me 5.5 years to do the first novel. Throwaway Horses I did in 14 months. The Last House in Covington Lane I wrote in 3.5 months.
Wow.
And, I didn't leave my office. I worked like 12 hours a day. And The Reincarnation of Tess Hamilton, I just finished this year. But what I do, you know, these novels are like 500 pages a piece. I go back, and I wrote the third book. So then I had to go back to the first book and put better clues, because these all interlock. They start in 1979 and end up present day.
So you have a timeline that you have to manipulate to to create events. Yeah, and
I just have to take the calculator out to figure out what age they are too.
Yeah, wouldn't that be? That's a little frustrating. Now I will go back to this all the time, because from what I have seen about reading about your work, I have to say there's a thread of truth in there. Now I'm not sure which thread of your stories is the Lura thread. But in there, I sense that there's some of you there.
Oh, there's a lot of me there, and things that have happened to me. And it actually, you know, the details of, you know, the descriptions of seeing a ghost and the different paranormal events in my life. I mean, I've done some radio shows and some articles, but most of the stuff I have kept secret because I've put it into, you know, my novels. But what I'm hoping after, you know, if I get some good success with these novels, that I hope that the readers can guess the real paranormal events in my life. I'm going to put out that challenge eventually.
Yeah, and by reading through the chronology of books, yeah, definitely there should be a nice, clear detective story right through there to bring it to present day. That'd be very interesting indeed. So, The Last House on Covington Lane. I got to tell you, I lived on Covington Lane.
Really?
So,
that's a very British name, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it just? Yeah, this was just in Shropshire in England, Covington Lane. There was a house at the end of the lane that was, you know, kind of a little grayer and darker than the rest.
Uh-huh.
And when I read this, The House on Covington Lane, it's like, oh, my gosh. Tell me about it.
Well, I like Sharon Landry so much. I took two novellas, and I put them together to make the novel. So you've got in all of my books, I have part one and part two, so they could be separate movies. So I'm thinking ahead like a businesswoman to some degree. But, you know, the historic house that Sharon Landry actually buys, I did a lot of detail, and there's a story and a mystery that happened and a hanging in, the War of 1812. So I wrote extensively about that. We have some really cool characters, you know, from, one of the ghosts from 1812 that, you think may inhabit the house, but I can't really give out too many clues. But it makes it different, you know? It's not your classic, you know, haunting some young ingenue, you know, that died a terrible death. It's a lot more tricky and complex than that. And I've got some ghosts in the last house in Covington Lane that you are introduced to in Throwaway Horses that, you know, frequent my character, Sharon Landry, and then it puts the pieces together. So there is an ongoing mystery about this one ghost. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yep. And it's got an old world kind of play to it too, which I kind of like. I must admit that one's going to be interesting. I'm going to pick that one up, and that'll be my winter reading. I think it's one of those fireside books. That's what it's
called. I'm so much better of a writer than an explainer. You know, I'm not that great at explaining.
Well, It's hard to do in 500 words or less. It really is. I mean, it's impossible. One hour shows are never enough to really get to the essence of a good book or a good author. But I do like the style of books. The Reincarnation of Tess Hamilton. What's that one about?
Well, I have a minor character in the first novel, Tess Hamilton. That is, she's a little bit in the second one. But what happens is, it starts in New York City. And something happens to her, and she remembers her whole past life as Abigail Cantrell, living in Lexington, Kentucky, just before the Battle of Perryville during the Civil War. And it's not a romantic version of Gone with the Wind, nothing like that. A border state was a split, divided state, and it was a different type of war than if you were north or if you were south.
Right.
And I did a lot of research in this to make sure that, you know, it's historically accurate. And I went to Civil War reenactments. I read more books than I want to tell you so I could get this right. And there's also this really distinct race of people called Melungeons. Have you ever heard of the Melungeons?
Melungeons. No, I
haven't. Melungeons. No, would you like to hear about it? It's kind of cool.
Sure, absolutely.
I have this Cora Mullins is, you know, like the housekeeper, and she is a Melungeon, and when Abigail goes to the house, she's very shocked. And this is historically pretty accurate. There was Portuguese sailors hundreds of years ago that were shipwrecked off the Carolinas, like 1,000 of them. I mean, there was a huge, huge group of Portuguese men. And no one came to pick them up, so they went inland. They intermarried with Native American Indians. They stayed together, and they had European customs and lived in houses and, you know, European fashion jewelry. And these people, I see them in Kentucky every once in a while. They're very, very dark skin and coal black hair that's straight, and then those beautiful blue eyes that you've ever seen. Very, very handsome handsome nationality. I guess they created their own nationality or whatever you call it, and they call themselves Portuguese. And I put this into the story, and it's kind of important, but it's just a little bit of Kentucky, the Kentucky flavor that's pretty interesting. And just little things like that, like the John Hunt Morgan house here, and had to be historically accurate. And, you know, what life was back in the Civil War, how conversation was more deliberate and more polite and more poised. And poor Abigail is an intellectual in a time when it meant nothing if you were a woman to be brilliant. So she's nobody's fool, and she's very, very interesting. And things don't go well for her in the end, so that adds to more mystery. And it links, there's huge connection to the first book, to the romance of the first book. So without telling too much, it's 500 pages. It's a good read. And I have one more book that I'm doing after that. Hello? Are you there? Did I lose you? Have I put you to sleep? Hello? I think we have a technical difficulty, and I may be talking to myself. Hello?
And I hope I am back on the air. We're not sure. We still do not see a dashboard, so I'm not sure what telephone lines are open or closed. And Laura is probably hanging in there with a closed microphone, driving herself and myself probably crazy. But we are trying to get back to the switchboard on blogtalkradio.com. Their switchboard system just closed down on me, which leaves us in a very precarious position when you're counting on the type of technology we are running tonight to get this show out on the air. So I am not sure if we're broadcasting. According to all indications, we are with an open phone line through Skype, and that Skype line looks like it is showing clear. So we are just waiting for the dashboard, blogtalkradio.com, to come back up. So we're talking with Laura Kettledge regarding some very impressive books that Laura has written. And some of the stuff, Last House on Covington Lane, it caught my attention, maybe because of the British in me, I'm not quite sure, but it had that title. You know, it's like a movie. It's like a radio show. It's like, it's like a book. It has the title, The Last House on Covington Lane. I like that. So as we look at, by golly, will you look at that? It looks like we may actually be getting something. We're not quite sure, but something is coming up on the board, so hopefully the board will be up in a few seconds and we'll be back at it. But Laura's book, Near Death Connection, that was it's a very esoteric book at first. It's a little difficult getting into, but once you're there, once you've established the story in your mind, then as you whisk through the storylines, you'll find that there's a lot of similarities of life, if you will. Now, yes, as my tweet is telling me, we are vamping as we load up, hopefully load up Blog Talk's switchboard so we can actually get back to the show and see where everybody is, if there's anybody there at all. And whether we're whistling to the wind with a dead microphone or whether there is actually a live microphone to be had, and if Laura is still hanging in there hoping to goodness I can get this thing up and running. So we are about 10 seconds away, and I do see Laura up waiting patiently. I'm going to try and open up her microphone. Laura, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh, God bless. God bless Blog Talk.
I kept talking for 10 minutes, and I thought, well, gee, he isn't asking any questions. Just joking.
You know, what can I say? Yeah.
It's all right. I always talk so much. I don't even need to have a conversation with anybody else.
We fell down, go boom. So, you know, there wasn't much I could do about it. For some reason, every so often they decide to punish me, we fall down, go boom. So,
well, it's a love-hate relationship with high technology, isn't it?
It is, especially with my high technology, I'll tell you. But so anyway, that, just going back to this Julia Goodman story.
Julie, yeah.
Did you draw that genre? Did you draw that image from real life?
Yes. Well, yeah. Actually, about 15 years ago, I was in the hospital. I was very, very sick. And the woman across the hall died. It was pretty upsetting. And I was pretty sick, and I guess it was my fourth or my fifth day there. I can't remember, and things weren't going well. And then, as I say, I had company. A ghost came in the hospital room, and I had the room to myself, and I just looked up, and I knew somebody was in here. I thought, oh, my gosh, are they coming for me? Are they coming for the lady across the hall? And I decided to just roll over and let it go. And, you know, if I went in my sleep, that would be okay. And I got up the next morning, and I felt better. I felt so much better. And the poor woman across the hall had perished. And I was wondering, that ghost probably was coming in for her, to guide her. And that kind of got me feeling, you know, what if this had happened to my character? How could I spin this? And then I came up with the idea of this poor little girl laying in bed, you know, dying from natural causes, from kidney failure. And back in the 60s, you couldn't really save a patient. And to comfort her, all of these different relatives stepped out of nowhere and encircled her, some from the past last century. And the nurse, who was a psychic, who saw them, just put her chart down, turned out the light, and left the room. And because little Julie wasn't dying alone, she didn't need the nurse.
Right. So, using those experiences, when you get them to paper, do you feel drained that you have drawn this out of yourself?
No, I feel exhilarated. The whole thing, when I get on a roll and I'm writing all the stuff, there's a creativity. I don't even know where it comes from. I don't even think it was natural for me to have, and it just comes out. And I go over this. I do a lot of editing, of course, but I get the bones of the story out.
Right.
And once I get the bones of the story out, then I go back and I fluff and I connect, and it's just something that is a joyful project. It's extremely, you have to really, really focus. I mean, it takes a lot of energy,
right?
A lot of concentration.
Now, when you make the decision you're going to write a book, is it because the influence built up inside of you, so to speak, is ready to come out, or do you just feel a calling to begin a book based on XYZ?
No, these books are all interlinked. You know, it's a series. It's a saga.
Right.
And I have one more book, The Near-Death Conclusion, that I'm going to write. It's already outlined. And everybody reconnects. And all these interactions that you think that, you know, were singular and not connected, everything kind of happened for a reason to build up to the climactic end of this, the next book, and it's kind of a Shakespearean ending, but it's got a lot of twists and turns, so it's definitely a paranormal adventure ride.
Right.
Because I really let loose, and I don't hold back in this last story.
Now, when you finish this one, and it goes to press, and people gobble it up like they're going to gobble everything else up, are you starting another chronology of a different style? Or are you taking a break and allowing the four books to grow? Or?
Well, what I'm doing is with these three books, they're going to different publishers to try to get a literary deal, a publishing deal, but I'm also going to pitch them to Hollywood at the same time. And I've outlined the fourth novel, and I've also outlined like a sci-fi thing that I want to do, a vampire sci-fi book that is just, you know, kind of like me doodling and goofing, and it's not a big project. But I have one more novel to write. So I thought I'd take a little bit of a break and do another fun adventure. I'm writing and producing a low-budget horror movie. Now, this is nothing near anything like my novels. It's just me goofing around having a good time. It's like Shaun of the Dead is a favorite zombie movie. I'm going to have slow zombies, so I'm going to do... I've already bought the Dominion name. It's called Another Apocalyptic Zombie Movie, and it's going to be a zombie comedy because I love comedy.
This sounds interesting.
Yeah, but after that, it's just a warm-up for my other movie. I'm going to write and produce a serious movie, all low-budget, called The Accidental Psychic, and that's going to be autobiographical. It's going to be my story.
Okay, I will do that. And Alan from Spirit Finders says hi.
Oh, great.
He's one of your zombie fans.
Oh, I just love him.
So so you're a budding movie producer for horror movie.
Well, I kind of wanted to do something different because I wanted to diversify, and I've always wanted to do produce a movie. Write and produce a movie, and I can't act. Plus, I wouldn't want to act. I don't think anybody would want to see me act anyways. I thought this would be really good, and I'll take a year, and I'll do these two movies, and I'll be doodling away at my last novel. But I need 2 years to write a novel. I mean, it's a long process, so I thought I'd do these two movies and have a great time doing it, and it's not as serious as my novels are. So it's kind of a vacation.
Right. Right. So for how you are getting along in the movie deals and what have you, and if somebody needs to contact you, they can contact you through luraketch.com, right?
That'd be great. Yeah.
LuraKetch.com, luraketch.com. So that's get that out of the way. With all of the locations that your book takes us to and mm-hmm. from where you've been in your personal lifestyle, which was the most that you felt in tune with when you were writing? Where did you find the most energy to write?
Well, I think I felt just drawn to write Throwaway Horses. I mean, it was kind of a minor idea, a minor book in my mind, you know, because the near-death connection was, quote, it. But I got so into the Throwaway Horses and putting all kinds of detail. I went to the Historical Society. I got maps. I mean, the legwork I did was absolutely a blast, and I enjoyed it, but it was pretty meticulous. And when I started writing about it and writing at the turn of the century, what Ormond Beach, Florida was like, the old Flagler Hotel, the Coquina Hotel that was torn down, and I guess in 1970, and I used to swim there as a child. It just took on this huge life of its own, and it was probably the most joyful project I've ever had with Throwaway Horses.
And do you think it cleared up some questions you may have had through your experience, your journey? Do you think it's helped you on your journey by writing them?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. In my house here in Kentucky alone, I've had over 75 ghostly visitations in 8 years. So my psychic abilities really have accelerated the last 5 years.
Now, you had a couple of paranormal investigations on your farm. What was that all about? Mm-hmm.
I had two teams. One team had seen me on television, the Kentucky Spirit Seekers, and they came out. And they didn't come out for that long. They were only here like 4 or 5 hours. But in that short amount of time, they had positive evidence, EVPs, electronic voice phenomena.
Right.
So they had EVPs, which were quite interesting. And then a month later, a different team, and these were not affiliated with each other. There was no collusion. The World Paranormal Investigation Team came all the way from Ohio, and we had a seance, and they spent the night And there were really some different findings than there were EVPs, but we have they photographed I don't know what they call them, shadow people. I'm not up on the lingo.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, shadow people. Yeah, I could see. Yeah.
Shadow. There was this cluster of shadows going across the wall, and then we had all these electrical problems, like, you know, all the cameras and the movie cameras and stuff stopped. All the cameras in the house and electronic equipment stopped, paused, and then all came back on a moment later.
I should get you in touch with my friends over at the South Jersey Ghost Research Group. The ladies are fearless. They will go into the jaws of death for a good EVP. So,
I've got a bunch of EVPs if they're interested in hearing them. Listen, I'm about as non-techie as they get, so I don't even know how to do them here. But there is paranormal activity going on in my home here, my farm here in Kentucky. But I've also been told that the paranormal activity more than likely could be following me. I don't know.
Right. Have you done a history check of your area?
Yeah, I sure have. There is a lost Civil War cemetery on this street somewhere.
Ah, okay. So
but I haven't seen any Civil War soldiers myself.
Right. But you could still be tapping into some pretty heavy paranormal activity that you're maybe just not tuned into yet. You're tuned in a different direction.
It very well could be. There's more that I don't know than I know. I mean, like, I know what I've experienced, but I haven't read other people's books or anything like that, or I'm not up on the paranormal lingo because I didn't want anything to learn about any other things. I didn't want it affecting my books. So for 30 years, I didn't read anything other than Robert Monroe's books. That was it.
Right. Yeah. There is a danger of getting slick with a book and using the lingo that really shows the book for the fiction that it is instead of the human effect that it is.
Yeah. I really wanted my novels to be original, and nobody helped them but me and spell check.
Yeah. Now, on the website, lauraketchka.com, the music, what is the music that plays on your website?
I think it's called the Ghost Waltz or the Death Waltz, I think. I have this really great guy that does my website, and, you know, anybody can find him. You can click on the bottom of the page and go to him. He's fantastic. He did all this designing because I'm so non-techie.
Right. Well, whatever the music is, it definitely fits the page. It's very well put together. So Lura, LuraKetch.com for all of those people that are wondering what the heck I'm going blah blah about. But there you can get references to all of Lura's books and also about Lura. And you've got a media page there, where hopefully we can get our media site up there so you can listen to the show.
Oh, I'm definitely putting a link to it.
Good girl.
Yeah.
That's what we like to hear.
I've got about 50 shows on my site.
That's fabulous. That's the way it should be. The more shows we have, the more information that is getting out there to the public. And that's part most of the battle, I would say.
I think there's other people like me that were just, you know, regular people going about their lives, and then the paranormal was just dumped on their lap right out of the blue.
Right. Yeah. And it is a calling, whether we realize it or not. As you said, you had no intentions of writing a book. It wasn't your first idea, your plan.
No, not at all.
Although you were always writing. Isn't that interesting?
Well, I was writing in my mind, thinking, mulling things over, but, you know, I'm not a big, I can type, but I never do longhand.
Right. Yeah, that would be difficult. I remember my father taught himself how to do shorthand so he could take notes at minutes of meetings, and that fascinated me for years.
Oh, shorthand's tough.
It is tough. It's like a code of its own, you know, it's bizarre, but I'm glad that the books came together. Now, you're working on the final chapter of this series?
Yeah, the near-death conclusion, I have it completely outlined, and I know what's going to happen. I've just got to, you know, what I call do the, you know, meat and potatoes, lay the bones out, and fill it in. So it's sort of like building, you know, building a little castle, you know, doing the foundation. But I know where everything's going to go. It's very strange. Before I sit down and write a novel, I know pretty much what's going to happen. And
now,
then I surprise myself when more stuff happens.
Did you, or do you plan characters from previous books only to make sure you can reactivate them into the current book? Is that
yeah,
how you...
The central character, Jack Caulfield, in the first book, he doesn't come back. You miss him in book two and book three, and then he comes back a very changed man, and not for the better in the last novel. And he's kind of a sad guy. It was hard having a man be my central character because I, you know, have the effeminate, you know, view on things. But Jack is a combination of people I've met in this world. I mean, there's people that I know that maybe I haven't really liked, and they make my best villains.
Mm-hmm.
Villains
are
fun to write.
The villains are easier because you don't have to use as much emotion. You can turn your emotion to sadness, can't you? It's quite, it's good to... Laura, it's been an absolute blast. See, I told you we'd blow through an hour just like that.
Yeah. Oh, it's just been great to be part of your show. You know, your show is informative. People enjoy it. You need to be on the air more often and longer, I have to say, because we want to have more of your shows.
Well, we appreciate it very, very much. And make sure we get you to come back another time, all right?
That'll be great. That'll be great. Okay. Thank you so much.
Take care.
My pleasure.
Night.
Good night.
Ladies. Everybody will be happy, and we'll have a good time. Next week, we got Nita Hickok is coming back with us. Nita is going to bring us up to date with all of the things that has happened over the last year and a half. Nita has been on some pretty long sabbatical on a journey, and she comes back to North America with some very interesting and, I must say, fascinating aspects about life. So that'll be happening next week. So we look forward for you to come and listen to the Night Zone next week. And I'm just trying to think. Am I back? Yeah, I'm back in Calgary. So we'll be able to have a good time with all of the bells and whistles, we hope. But you never know. It doesn't always happen. We got to get out of here. Maybe.
Many.
Hey, Night Zoners, got a minute? I'm sure we all know someone who is experiencing difficult times during this recession, either with unemployment or financial problems, or in relationships. I have friends like that. I would like to remind you that we are all in this together. So if you have friends experiencing hardships, support them with your advice. If you have acquaintances who are having rough times, nurture them with your friendship. Show them kindness. If you have family members who are having difficulties, show them your love. And if you have people in your life who have almost given up, throw them a lifeline of kindness. Remember the golden rule, but for the grace of God, go I. Blessings upon your household. Until then, next time we meet.
This has been a Night Zone production in association with BlogTalkRadio.com.
And this is where the show ends, right?